Hello and welcome to the Doc Arena podcast in association with Film Ireland. My name is Ross Whittaker, and every fortnight or so I talk to documentary makers about their docs, both in terms of the subjects they choose and the way in which they fund, craft and distribute their work. In this episode, I discuss Copa 71 with directors James Erskine and Rachel Ramsey. The film tells the incredible story of the 1971 Women's Soccer World Cup, a tournament witnessed by record crowds that has been written out of sporting history, until now. Featuring stunning unseen archive and told by the women themselves, it is an immersive and well-told tale. Most of the players were mocked and derided after the tournament, so this, for the first time, is their account of an amazing sporting moment. Here's my chat with Rachel and James. So, Rachel and James, thanks a million for joining me. James, would you mind by starting by telling us a little bit about what the film's about?
Yeah, Copa 71 is about the extraordinary and long-lost story of one of the most remarkable sporting events ever to take place in history, the 1971 unofficial Women's World Cup, which took place in Mexico City, involved teams from six countries around the world, and the final of which was viewed by over 100,000 people live in the Azteca Stadium, which is the biggest crowd ever, a live crowd at a women's sporting event, still to this day. And our film tells the story of the women who participated in the event and the event itself, and shows footage that hasn't been seen for 50 years of this remarkable event that was somehow wiped from history.
Yeah, you say it was wiped from history, and even that statistic of it being the highest attended women's sporting event, I feel like in the Guinness Book of Records, there was a different number in there for a few years. I remember looking it up myself years ago. But Rachel, it is an erased event, a kind of lost event. How did you guys come across it, and how did you find it and bring it to life?
We came across it through our producer, Victoria. So the team that had been representing England had lost contact with each other for over 50 years. And they had just reunited and were helped to do so by a BBC journalist, and so there were some interviews with them on radio and then actually on the one show on the BBC as well, and we realized that if this, you know, there was this little snippet of this information, but there was no footage, and there was we started to understand actually quite how big this thing might be. And we started off by talking to the team in England, and then we found the team in Mexico, and then the French teams, Italian, Danish, Argentinian, and started to realize that this was truly a global and international movement that had been happening. These women had been playing in this sort of subculture of football across the world throughout the 60s and earlier than that. But then you start to realize, okay, well, one of the reasons that it had become a subculture is that actually, you know, it was banned for women to play under the Football Association, under the English FA in 1921. Women were banned from playing on affiliated pitches. And that was picked up around the world because a lot of people were copying the English rules and the English practice. It was actually illegal in Brazil until the 1980s for women to play football. And so when you start to realize that this is sort of some, you know, when it starts to feel a bit like a grand conspiracy, and there's all these ideas, you know, the reason that women's football is not so popular now and is not as big as men's football is, you know, they're not very good and they never wanted to play, and they and there was never going to be commercial. And then you see one tournament from over 50 years ago that completely blows that entirely out of the water. And then you think, well, yeah, this is a story that absolutely needs to be told. And this is the kind of thing you want to put your resources and your time and your effort and your care into. And then we were incredibly fortunate to be able to find the actual original footage, which, yeah, hasn't been seen in 50 years. We knew it had been live broadcast. The organizers used the same infrastructure of the Men's World Cup from 1970, which incidentally was the first World Cup that had been... the men's one in 1970 was the first World Cup that had been broadcast in colour. And so, yes, we found the original colour footage. And it came from lots of different sources in the end. It's all pieced together, frame by frame, with really wonderful editors and, you know, team of archivists from around the world. It was it was quite a feat.
Yeah, because the 1970 footage is so iconic. Brazil winning the World Cup in that kind of
you know, early kind of satellite, probably shot on film kind of footage. It's really, really memorable footage. And then when you start to watch your documentary, you realize the footage that you have is very, very similar, you know, and it has almost, it feels like it has that same kind of iconic quality. What was the process, James, of finding all of that?
The process of finding it was long and arduous, I think. You know, it was really, you know, it was a team of researchers, archivists around the world, really. We went to every archive to find not just footage of 1971, but of women's football in general, and women's football having been shot in a way that was serious. You know, I think there's a montage in the film quite early on set to Nancy Sinatra and showing the explosion of the underground of women's football. But, you know, that's probably pieced together from 12 different countries, you know, and we were scrabbling around to find nice footage that showed it as a real game. You know, there was plenty of really bad, well, there were a number of really bad sort of TV reports mocking the women's game, you know, that weren't shot properly, but looking to show the athleticism and the beauty of the beautiful game, you know. And so we were, but with 71, we were fortunate. I mean, you know, you talk about the colors and the richness of the film. That was a lot of the film stuff came from a single collector who wasn't even aware that they had the material. It had been shot by their grandfather, and they had stumbled across it happily towards the end of our production period.
2 weeks before the end, it was very tight. Suddenly, beautiful footage arrived. And he'd been digitizing his grandfather's collection. And we'd put out a call on social media in Mexico. And by that time, we'd got to know a lot of Mexican football contacts and working with these great Mexican archivists. And everyone shared it on, you know, we just put out a message saying, were you or any of your family at any of these games in 1971? That's what came back. Which was a real treat, if not a little bit stressful.
In relation to that archive, and if you look at the credits of the film, you see a huge number of archive sources. But one thing that's very noticeable when watching it is that it feels very cohesive, you know, and even if a sequence is coming from several different places, it does feel cohesive. And I suspect you did some stuff with colorization as well on some footage and so on. Just if you could talk a little bit about your approach to archive and I suppose making sure that it didn't feel like you were cutting from one thing to another thing and everything jumping around and feeling different.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should give a shout out here to Marina Amaral, our incredible colour artist who is a New York Times bestseller. She worked on a book called The Colour of Time. We've worked with her a number of times. So we tasked her to bring the a lot of black and white photos and some black and white footage into what it was actually really like, you know. I mean, of course, those photographs were recorded in black and white, but the world that they were recording was full of color, you know. So we asked her to restore those to the vibrancy of what they should be. So really that was a big part of the sort of trying to get those colors right and match all the colors across so that there was a real consistency. And again, you know, as Rachel said, it's really the editors that bring out the value of the archive. I mean, we look at it and we say we like this and we like that, but they really need to bring out the action, the timing and the points of view to make you feel like, you know, it's important to us that you saw it not just as TV coverage, you know, that you saw it from pitch level, that you saw the audiences, that you felt like you were inside the stadium following the action rather than being led into the action by sports commentary. So it didn't feel like a clip show, it felt like you were inside a drama, you know. And I think that's a very big thing that the editors bring, is that they really look to tell the story, the sporting story, through the characters on the pitch, not so much just the teams on the pitch.
Yeah, I think we should also do a shout out for the sound design as well. So obviously all of the you know, that's I think what makes it so immersive as well, and you know, everything's layered and layered and layered to really take you into the space and make you feel like you're in the stadium. And, you know, and obviously the music helps with that as well, but you want to really feel the real life sounds, which, you know, don't exist on a lot of the archive anyway.
Women's football, you know, as is stated at the end of the documentary, and many people know, is the fastest growing sport in the world right now. And I think that's pretty plain for anyone's eyes that's paying any attention, that the sport is growing in popularity so quickly. But you probably started this project a few years ago, and while women's football is very popular, I imagine it may not be as easy to get a film about women's football funded as some other films. Now, having said that, maybe I'm wrong, because the film feels very well funded and, you know, well made. The production value is high. There's great music in there. Can you talk a little bit about the funding process and how that worked?
You are correct. It does. It was not easy to get funded.
I would say no film is easy to get funded, you know, especially a film about social issues. But yeah, it was not straightforward to get it funded. Although we were very lucky in the end, we had a single financier come in and make sure that we could make the film as best we could. We were fortunate that there was a zeitgeist, but you know, at the beginning there was no money. We had to sort of build it piece by piece, and fortunately ride the wave of enthusiasm towards women's football that came out of, you know, the Lionesses and in the Euros, and then obviously the World Cup.
We did start this, you know, quite a while before the Euros and before the Lionesses had quite grabbed everyone's attention. But I think there was a lot of understanding that the story was fantastic, and we believed that we had amazing storytellers in the women that we'd been speaking to. We knew that they could carry the story themselves. But that was the other element that was difficult with some potential financiers or some potential people we were taking it to, is that there's not many comparisons for having women of that age on screen telling their stories. And when people ask for comps, or they ask to say, you know, this is going to be like what? And you're like, well, there aren't any versions of women in their 70s and 80s telling their story themselves. I think one of them, someone said, well, you know, I think we can do Calendar Girls. And you're like, well, this is not quite the, that's the only one you can come up with. And I think we need to start making more of these. So that was a bit of a tricky sell as well. And the multiple languages and this, you know, I think we've never had any complaints about multiple languages. Actually, I think people really enjoy feeling like it's being told from all around the world. So yeah, there were a few elements that made it less than straightforward. But as James says, you know, no film is easy to get funded.
Yeah, I wonder if we could delve into this a little bit more, because, you know, it was said it was funded by one financier. I mean, one of the things we're hearing in documentary funding now is, you know, is kind of docbusters and celebrity docs and all those kinds of things. And this film doesn't inhabit that world, even though, you know, I suppose football has its own IP and you are riding on the back of people's knowledge of World Cups and so on and so forth. But how do you see documentary funding now and the way, I suppose, that you see in some cases a single financier coming in and backing a film? Is that kind of thing affected how you go about financing your films?
I mean, you know, it's interesting you talk about now. I mean, you know, to be honest, you know, a year or so ago when we got this funded, it was easier than now. Now is like not a great time to get documentaries funded. Believe me, a lot of the big players that we were working with have sort of dropped out the market. You know, prices have fallen. So it's really tough. I'd say it's one of the toughest times that I've seen in the last decade to get people to Kerala on that. What we need to have is more documentaries coming out in cinemas and more revenue. And, you know, streamers are fantastic and they take stuff on and they really bring stuff on, but they, in a way that sort of, you know, the consumer's getting stuff for cheap that way. If they're paying 10 quid a month for Netflix as opposed to £10 every time they go to the cinema, you know, the economics don't add up. It's like what happened in the music industry to some extent. You know, it's hard for bands to creating new music, you know, if people aren't really paying the true cost, you know, just as a restaurant wouldn't survive if it gave its food away. So, you know, what really needs to happen is people need to support documentaries and support them by going and seeing at the cinema and not just waiting for them to arrive for free. You know, I think not that it's entirely for free, you know, and obviously the consumer has a right to choose, but I think that's what really the industry needs to pick up. And is, you know, post-pandemic is obviously challenging, but we'd love to see a lot of people come to see Copa 71 at the cinema, and that's sort of to remind them how great it is to see a doc in the cinema. You know,
we put a lot of thought into making this a film that you can watch in the cinema and you should watch in the cinema and does feel immersive. And there's also something specifically we think about this film, that it's a lot of fun to watch with other people. You know, crowd really gets behind it. And I think the feeling of being inside this, being inside a room that's full, that's got the, you know, got a lot of energy behind it, and seeing that incredible, unusual, still quite mesmerizing footage on the big screen. And as you say, yes, there was a lot of post-production, a lot of care put into making that experience feel seamless and feel immersive, and having it with the full sound. You know, we think, you know, if we're asking people to go to the cinema to watch documentaries, then we want to make it worth their while as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and you're so ambitious with the film, and one of the things about it is how you go about telling the story in terms of, because we haven't actually seen that many films in this space, it's an opportunity in a way to go and look at the history and go back to the fact that the sport was illegal and that it was almost an underground movement. Was that something that was important to you to really place it in that context?
Well, we didn't intend to, you know, we set out to not make a film about the history of women's football. You know, we felt like it was much more deserving to say, okay, we're going to tell the story of this one tournament, but yes, you have to put that tournament in context. But, you know, we've said before that there's whole books, films, series made about, you know, single men's matches, tournaments, single goals, single players. And we felt keenly that we wanted to show that, you know, the women's game and their experience deserve the same treatment. So we really hope that people will go and make many other films about all of the other parts, you know, the other secret parts of, you know, not just football, but, you know, women's sport in general.
Yeah, I think it's also really important that, you know, this is obviously a historical story, you know, but actually it's about making the stories about now as well. It's not just about stuff that happened, you know, this great moment. Nobody else can make Copa 71 again. We found the long lost hidden record breaking tournament, you know, but there's lots of stories, you know, that don't get to the fore of brilliant female athletes, you know, that are playing now. They're not given the space either by broadcasters or filmmakers or, you know, anywhere really. And I think until you know, storytelling, you know, is about building heroes to some extent, you know, and I think the more opportunity we have and the more opportunity people seize to find heroes within from women's sport, you know, and tell them on the big screen, then I think the more people will be excited about the sport itself.
Certainly in women's football, you're seeing that already, aren't you? And there's a great moment in the documentary where, you know, for reasons of kind of almost censorship of women's football, they can only play in the Azteca, which just happens to be pretty much the biggest stadium in the world. And then it's a real case of if you build it, they will come, you know, because they're like, well, we're going to have to promote this now. I mean, it must have been incredible for you to see that footage for the first time of the Azteca absolutely full to the brim.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, it still is. Like, you know, still watch it now or see the trailer or anything, and I think, gosh, yeah, it did, because, you know, you're told what one thing we were interested in doing was allowing that, you know, what for making it so immersive was to allow the audience to really feel like they're living that tournament, so that when it's taken away in the same way that it was taken away from the women that experienced it, there's that real gut-wrenching feeling of like, gosh, like hang on, but I just lived this, I experienced it did happen. You can't gaslight me, you can't tell me this didn't happen. And that's what these women went through for 50 years. It's effectively gaslit by the rest of the world, telling them that their experience wasn't relevant and mocking it. And I think, yeah, that's the sort of a feeling we wanted people to have. And that's, I think, and then obviously that's helped immensely by the fact that the footage is there, does exist, and does look and feel as impressive as the first time you watch it.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, Rachel's talked about gaslighting, and, you know, for a lot of the women, they never saw themselves, you know. The England players were in the stadium, you know. They weren't watching on a television set themselves, you know. They've never, until they came to the London Film Festival screening, they'd never seen themselves play, but they played at the Azteca. So try telling that story to down the pub and go, yeah, oh, but there's no pictures, no video, no, there's nothing. Yeah, sure, you know, it's not like you're bragging rights. So like, yeah, sure, and I played at Wembley Stadium and scored a hat trick. There's plenty of people that tell tall tales in sport, you know, and you know, it's great that these women have the chance to say, no, look, here it is.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it from perspectives, you know, the Argentinian team get to say that, actually, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but, you know, the Argentinian women's team playing in the Azteca years before the Argentinian men's team. They have their own bragging rights. And as do each of the teams in, the countries now as the film is coming out. We're getting so many excited. I've got various WhatsApp groups going on still with all of the players. And that's something that's so wonderful, going back to the idea of documentaries in cinemas, that's something that's so wonderful now is for us, because you never make any promises, of course, in this whole process, and you're very careful not to, and to manage expectations. And if you're asking people to share their life story with you and they're entrusting you with it, it really is on us to not just make the film for the benefit of making it, for the sake of making the film, it's to get it out there. And if they can go and they can take their grandkids, they can tell their neighbors, they can tell anyone down the pub, as James says, well, yeah, you can go and see me. I'm like, we're in the cinemas now. And that feels very exciting. And we know how much that means to them and to, and to anyone that's been touched by that story, I think.
And considering that they were kind of erased from history, and to a certain extent, as you just alluded to, they were mocked on return to home. Did you find there was any reticence on their part to participate when you approached them?
Yeah, pretty much all of them at the very beginning. And that was a gentle process to talk to them and to, you have to, if you're asking people to share their story, then usually we've found that if you have to share something of yourself as well, and you have to take it slowly, and you have to, you go and visit them first without cameras, and then you come back later. And you approach each person on an individual basis as well, which is why, probably most documentaries don't have this many contributors. this is unusual in the number of people who are involved. But you can't treat them as a team or as a unit of women. They're all individuals, and they've had completely different experiences. I mean, they share a lot in terms of there's a shared sisterhood, there's a shared idea. They have a lot in common despite all their backgrounds, but they are all, they're all different, and it takes a different approach and different and levels of care with each person.
Was it a case of interviewing them as you went along, or did you manage to sort of interview them all in one go, or did you kind of have to accumulate some interviews to show what you had? Like, what was the kind of approach from that point of view?
Started out approaching them all individually, and you're on the phone, Zoom calls. A lot of that was in the early days of COVID lockdown. And then as that lifted, you're starting to go and visit them in person. And again, first time, no cameras, going to see them at home, recceing locations, having a look around, and then coming back later. And then, when we went into production, the actual production period was relatively short for filming and for the edit. And so you try and block together, we block together sets of filming started in England, then Denmark, Italy, Mexico, etc. But the way to do that is, you go to them. These women aren't coming to you. They're all, they know what they're doing. They're set. They're the stars of the show. And so, we're the traveling circus, really, rather than, and it's about making them feel confident. And we're very uncomfortable. And we're very keen to make each, the background of each place feel different for each of the teams, feel different. Different color palettes, and so you can recognize them more easily as you chop between them all. So that was all that's all carefully thought about. And that's also why there's such a brilliant team of people in each different countries. I mean, it'd be great to travel with your own crew all the time, but that's not always feasible or the most ecological or the most financially sensible approach. So you're working, within all of those kind of constraints as well.
I thought the way you ended the film, or the last 10 to 15 minutes of the film, was such a kind of emotional roller coaster. To be honest with you, watching it, felt quite a few emotions. And I was just wondering about how you thought about that, because, in a way that feels like we're kind of communicating something a little bit deeper. What was your approach to that in terms of what you wanted to communicate at the end of the film?
I mean, I think one thing that we really wanted to communicate is we wanted the film to feel, to not feel downbeat at the end. You know, I think we had to go very low to go very high again. You know, most sports films end when the team pick up the trophy or cross the line. It's very hard to go past that emotion. But we were very conscious that, you know, the entire film was really about what happened in the last 15 minutes, not actually what happened in the first 75, you know, in terms of it, what it meant to today, you know. So that was really important. So crafting that arc of going low and building back up without sort of being sort of it's all okay now, because it's not okay now, you know, was quite a lot to consider and bring everyone together, wasn't it, Rachel?
Yeah, because you want to sort of, you know, you want to touch on all of the themes that we've been looking at throughout the film, but do it subtly. You know, you don't want to hammer it over the head, sort of this idea of, you know, we looked at physicality, we looked at equal pay, we looked at being denied the right to self-expression, and all of those things are still relevant now. And that's why, you know, if you, there's, you know, using, I guess, sort of a montage, one of a better word, of how you can, reflecting how similar these the women were then and everything that they were dealing with, and saying, well, and just by putting those pictures together with the pictures of people, players now, and what's going on, is, you know, the understanding is implicit that yes, if we're happy to say that this was historical, and we can say, oh, it's 50 years ago, and yeah, or oh, wasn't it terrible back then, but it's still relevant now, and it's all pretty meta, you know. It's not, we've used football as the example here, but, you know, it could be, you could replace the concept of football with many other things, and not just sports as well. But, you know, you have to trust the audience that they will gather that and feel that, but also feel a celebration of it and wanting to move forward, and that these women have got their due as well, finally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you absolutely definitely achieved what you're setting out to do. I just wondered a little bit about that, because you needed to have the material to be able to do that, which is, you know, probably from an editing point of view, a little bit complex to get that emotional arc just right in those last 15 minutes. Was that something that you thought about from very early on in the process, or was that more something that you sort of came to later when you were in the edit?
I think we knew what we were setting out to achieve, but exactly how you were going to do it is something you do work out in the edit and with the help of the editors and with a lot of conversations. But, you know, I think something that's quite interesting is when we pitched this at Copenhagen Festival, CPH Docs, a couple of years ago, and that was part of us getting the funding. And, you know, the film that we pitched there is very similar to the film that you can watch on screen now, in terms of the how it makes you feel and what... how all the pieces of the puzzle we were going to put together, but exactly how you put them together, I guess, is, you know, the joy and pain of the editing process.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the thing about it is filmmaking is an art, not a science, you know. And you can imagine, you can say things in words, and that changes once you see pictures and once you lay music in, and actually once you realize, you know, you want to say all these things and all these people say interesting things, but actually sometimes you need to create space so that a single thought can land very simply and people can take it away with them, you know, and they and react, you know. I think, you know, that's one of the things that's always underestimated in the filmmaking process, is how the audience is reacting to what is given to them, because they're all reading the film and they're all reading it different to you, but they're also being stimulated in so many different ways. So I think the last 15 minutes, one of the great things about it is there is space for each idea to land. And they don't need to be oversaid, but it's very clear that we could have switched, you know, Carol for Berta, you know, that they were speaking with a single voice through six different languages, and I think that was the harmony that we were trying to land.
Yeah, and we should give a shout out to Rob Lord, the composer who did the original score, and I think that last piece is pretty excellent, and it does sort of stick in people's heads as well, and it really carries a lot of the excitement and celebration, I think, and gives it a real weight as well. I think
the tournament being as it was and a raised event, as you say, you did have that kind of responsibility to figure out, well, what do we say about this? And I just thought it was really well done. So well done on that. And in terms of people seeing it, you know, and having that response to it, and you've taken it to Toronto. I know it was in IDFA. I was over there and it was, the screenings were sold out. And so I know that it's already had a bit of a life in advance of the release, which is coming up now. What's the reaction kind of been to it? And have you got the kind of motivated reaction that you wanted from the audience? And also, what's it been like for the contributors?
I mean, the contributors are having an absolute ball. They're loving it. we were really lucky. We took Anne and Birte, from Denmark to Toronto. So they were with us at TIFF and they were on the stage with us doing Q&As. And they had a brilliant time. And now that it's been released in the UK and in Ireland, the England team are all up for it. Like, they're all doing press. They're doing their own local press. They're traveling around. And there's you know, getting more traction in Argentina and Mexico as well. And yeah, so that's been a lot of fun. And I think in terms of audience, you know, audiences watching, I mean, it's quite an audience participation film. People pick a team and just kind of, they just go with it, which is really good fun in some cases. But also the thing that I didn't expect was at the end of some screenings, I mean, this was happening at festivals, obviously, because we haven't actually released yet, but was young women, like in their 20s, coming up to us at the end, crying, and saying, you know, this is something, that this means so much somehow. And I think we hadn't, you hope to reach lots of different people, but there's a specific band of people that I wasn't quite expecting that. In their 20s, saying, you know, finally feeling seen and finally saying, you know, we understand now why this has been so difficult or why we felt like we were going a bit mad. And thank you for that. So that's been really nice.
So you're going to be coming out in cinemas now very shortly. What's kind of your hope for this release in the UK and Ireland?
Well, we're hoping to break box office records like they did at the Azteca Stadium. I mean, you know, listen, if 120,000 people come and see our movie, we'll be delighted. So, you know, it's opening on like 60, 65 screens across the country. You know, it's going to have some good promotion, and we're excited. People are excited that lots of people are going to come, hopefully wear their football jerseys to the cinemas. Certain cinemas are offering bonuses for people that do that on opening weekend. And yeah, we hope it makes an impact. We hope people remember it, talk about it, get their friends to come and see it too. And just sort of that this amazing moment is not only not forgotten, but it's talked about forever.
Okay, great. Well, listen, best of luck with it. I really enjoyed it. So I wish you all the best.
Right. Thank you very much. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks again to James and Rachel for taking part in the interview. Copa 71 is available to watch in selected cinemas from March 8th, which means it's in cinemas right now. Thanks to Stephen Galvin and Film Ireland for supporting the podcast, and to film composer Michael Fleming for kindly allowing me to steal his work. You can find more of it at michaelflemingmusic.com. You'll find me on social platforms as Ross Whitaker TV, and of course, thanks to you for listening.